Welcome to CYC Podcast, Discussions on Child and Youth Care, episode number 116. I'm Wolfgang Bashaw. I'm recording this interview today from the Unity Through Relationship Conference in Dublin, Ireland. Conferences are an amazing way to meet new people who are doing fascinating work related to children and youth, and this conference is no exception. I reached out to speak with the gentleman I'm speaking with today, Liam Curran. Liam is a qualified social worker and certified CDC educator of FASDs. He is currently undertaking his PhD at Concordia University in Montreal, Canada. Liam is also a member of the Center for Research on Children and Families at McGill University in Montreal. Liam's research focuses on how social workers respond to FASDs in child welfare settings in particular. Liam has researched and published numerous articles, chapters, and co-authored a book on the topic of FASDs from a social lens. And I'm particularly excited to speak with him today about what that means. So welcome, Liam, and thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Wolfgang, and indeed thank you for inviting me to maybe to discuss the topic of FASDs and the social lens.
Yeah.
I guess I have the social lens there in that I've been doing this work now for roughly 10 years since I first kind of fell into the work of researching. I think my first piece of research was asking if drug and alcohol use in pregnancy was a child welfare concern. It was a master's thesis study at Trinity College here in Dublin. And that's where I kind of started out. I suppose in the 10 years of doing the work, and I say, you said there, I published, I did different things. I trained across Europe. I did CPD training days with social workers. So CPD is continuing professional development. I did training days here in Ireland, in the UK, and in mainland Europe with social workers. And I suppose the more I developed in the training on fetal alcohol, the more I kind of developed this concept of a social lens, because I realized that a lot of my knowledge or a lot of my research was very much coming from a medical lens, but a lot of the requirements of those living with FSD, the foster parents, the adoptive parents, etc., are very much living in our social world, and they were looking to social work for some helps and supports and guidance when their child was diagnosed with a condition or when this condition emerged in their families.
So what would you say is the difference between a medical lens versus a social lens?
I think, you know, throughout kind of the whole kind of social policy area, like we've had kind of medical social kind of concepts. I mean, they're very strongly in the disability field. In the mainstream disability field, we can have a collaboration of medical and social working for the best needs of a child. I think in the context of what I'm dealing with now, we have a very heavy medical diagnostic lens on FASD and fetal alcohol. I suppose that you can talk about it purely in the level of scholarly articles that present are coming from a medical world. And there's a few social researchers, as I call them, myself. There's people like Dr. Dorothy Bardry in Alberta. There's Dan Dabosky in the US. He's a mental health social worker, but looking at the mental health side of fetal alcohol. So there's a couple of that's what I call the social model. It's looking at the lived experience. It's looking at the day-to-day lives of these children and their families, as opposed to a medical treatment model. It's looking at a social model that can help these individuals navigate the world that they live in, basically. That's kind of the difference that I see.
Right. Yeah. And what's the response that you have started to receive from, particularly from people in the child welfare system, foster parents, care providers, when you approach the topic from this social model?
I think the response is kind of, the response is very demanding. There's a big demand in foster care, in adoptive families, etc. There's a demand for basic information, and there's a demand for information that can be interpreted and used in a daily life. And I think, again, maybe some of the caregivers, they come, they've had that medical input, but it hasn't given them the practical. It hasn't given them the plain English
right.
of what they need or what they want in terms of having a child that has a neurodevelopment disorder, has what the world calls the leading cause of intellectual disability. But still, the world is still very much in denial that this disability exists. So these caregivers find themselves caught between two pillars. Yes, they need the medical. The medical is important in some context, but there's a very, very big social need of a life that's to be lived and a life that has to be navigated in our complex world today.
Indeed.
You know.
I'd like to take a step back for a moment and perhaps discuss a little bit about what is FASDs, right? And,
yeah.
And it's plural, right?
Yeah.
And there's lots out there around. So what is it? What isn't it? You know, how do we, you know, it's spectrum. So what does the spectrum look like?
Sure. I suppose that, I mean, when we talk about the foundations of FSD, we really go back to 1973. To again, the clinicians of Smith and Jones at the clinic in Washington. That research, interestingly, that was published in the Lancet Journal is kind of seen as the watershed of modern day understanding. Again, when I train in the social world, I often make reference to that paper, and that what's not often discussed in that paper or as a result of that paper was that it was social workers who took 8 children from the Washington child welfare system that had labels of failure to thrive. That it was social work who saw there was something beyond the label to thrive. And social workers took those children to the Washington clinic. And I say subsequently, I think Olland was the registrar that put together the pieces of fetal alcohol, and then Smith and Jones, and they published their paper in the Lancet Journal, and it's become the synonymous paper around the world today around fetal alcohol, and it's the starting point. But I do make that point. It was social work. It was children of the child welfare system. It was the failure to thrive label that was being seen prior to the diagnosis that these children had failure to thrive. And it's something that our child welfare system has now negated to engage with. Because failure to thrive label is kicked around in our child welfare services quite routinely for children that are coming into the system, that these children haven't thrived, these children haven't met their developmental milestones, etc. And so it's an interesting reminder to people of the 73 paper, that it was children of the child welfare system. Now, sorry, I digress today. I want to come back. So really from 73 onwards then, there was a lot of science and research, and there was papers came out. And then in 2004, the Center for Disease Control really formalized FASD as fetal alcohol spectrum disorders to encompass a number of diagnostic terms that fitted under that umbrella term. Again, it has evolved since 2004 up to today. I suppose the most significant benchmark that happened since then was 2013. The DSM-5 introduced neurodevelopment disorder as a result of prenatal alcohol exposure, NDPAE, which is, I think, 318.5 in the DSM-5. Now, it's interesting because neurodevelopment disorder, PAE, you know, and again, I would encourage people, maybe if they can get their hands on DSM-5, to have a look at it there, you know, that it is probably, again, it is the disability part, it's the diagnostic part of the FSD umbrella that's probably the most prevalent in our child welfare system, because it is the disability that is hidden in the brain. And there's no visible dysmorphic features of NDPAE. It's clearly a brain impairment that has happened as a result of prenatal alcohol exposure. And I think that's the kind of... So I suppose in 2017 that we are now, FASDs, the plural, would encompass, would be FAS, fetal alcohol syndrome, partial FAS, alcohol-related birth defects, and NDPAE. Those are the four main diagnostics that fall under that FSD umbrella. But I say, because there's four of them, they're plural, so we say FSDs. If you were talking about an individual that has one of those diagnoses, you would say he has an FSD. So it's an FSD. So it's one of those diagnostic criteria that is applied. So that's the kind of the terminology, plural if you're making a general statement, and an FSD for a singular.
Right.
Yeah.
And it, you and I have had some conversations about this and the idea of, you know, being in the DSM-5, diagnosis, the usefulness or potentially harmfulness of a diagnosis. What are some of the frictions that are happening in the, particularly from a social lens, not so much from a medical lens, but from a social lens, what are some of the benefits and the limitations of pursuing a diagnosis?
I think the diagnosis problem, it is a problem. I mean, and globally, we still struggle with the fact that there's no universal diagnostic criteria that is applied in any one jurisdiction. Within that, then, that you have what I suppose called postcode lottery. You have some areas and developed areas in the world where you've got multidisciplinary assessment center and diagnostics, etc. And that works. I mean, probably the most famous of that is Alberta in Canada. They have been since the early 90s addressing their whole FASD and their kind of child welfare piece in Alberta. A diagnosis in Alberta has merit because there's a cultural acceptance, there's a cultural awareness, there's a multidisciplinary assessment process, there's an element of care planning, etc., that therefore would follow. I suppose when we're in Europe here, I do worry because diagnoses are often happening in isolation or with a single clinician in a hospital, whatever. There isn't a social piece to it, and there isn't necessarily a defined care plan that would follow a positive diagnosis. And so certainly here in Europe, we are still struggling with whether a diagnosis has benefit or has not. Unfortunately, I have spoke to carers in the European network who got a diagnosis, but then we felt that the diagnosis became an impediment to them accessing services because they would say, well, my child has been diagnosed with fetal alcohol syndrome, but the services, oh, that's not something we cater for. We don't have that on our criteria, so therefore, no, we can't accept you. So I've actually spoke to a carer who actually then denied that they had a diagnosis in order to try and get services. And I think in her case, her child had a lot of sensory needs that could be met in an autism services. And therefore, she wanted to try and get her child this autism service. Right. But trying to weave the system by not acknowledging fetal alcohol. Right. And I suppose, Wolfgang, that is my concern with the whole debate around FASD and fetal alcohol is that we are 45 years in the right research from 1973. We are about 3 million publications. We have invested billions of dollars of taxpayers' money in understanding this disability. My difficulty is I'll stand in a lecture hall or I'll stand in a training session and I have people scratching their heads because they're saying, why didn't we know this? What, you know, why isn't this common knowledge? I gave a lecture in the McGill Network a couple of months ago and I had two fairly eminent profs come into the room and I was a little bit intimidated thinking, oh my God, blah, blah, blah. And my presentation finished and the hands went up and I thought, here we go. And it was someone and said, wow. And again, it was, why don't we know this? And that is what I'm feeling is the problem. Something has gone wrong. We're suffering from a tsunami of publications, but we're suffering in knowledge translation. And my ultimate kind of difficulty with that is that maternal and child health is the victim of that failure of knowledge translation.
And what do you mean by the maternal and child health is the...
Because I believe that in terms of the fact that women of childbearing age are confused around the alcohol and pregnancy message. No mother, I believe, wants to consciously do an action that could result in their child having a neurodisability. I don't believe that for a minute, that is a conscious decision. The problem is that because the alcohol in pregnancy message has become so confused because of social media, that women are confused. And that was shown very clearly by Dr. Kate Holland at the University of Canberra in, I think, maybe 2014. I think her study was that women want to know. Now, it's interesting if you read that study, because I think Dr. Holland and her team reviewed 120 social media postings of issues around alcohol and pregnancy in a kind of short window. I think it was about 8-week window. I can't remember specifically. Of that 120, she found that 70 were inaccurate. And 35, I think, went totally against the New Zealand state policy guidance. And this was her argument, and this is why the title of the study is Women Want to Know, is that women are being treated badly because they're not being given the correct, empowering information. Now, Wolfgang, I say to you that you know that I've been doing this work for 10 years. I've been trained. I mentioned there that I've done CPD trainings in Europe. 95% of the time, my delegates in those CPD trainings are females of childbearing age. And I would go through a whole day of training around fetal alcohol, but I would do the biology, the fetus, the whole context. I would do the cultural piece. I can show you today that I have women of childbearing age writing evaluations, thanking me for giving them the correct information. And that's all I've ever tried to do in this work, is to empower women with the correct information to be able to make an informed choice. Because I'm not in any level lecturing women and telling them what they must or must not do in pregnancy. I absolutely agree that women are kind of hit from all sides in pregnancy of what they should and shouldn't do. I am simply saying, please consider the scientific evidence and please make an informed decision for your own pregnancy and a healthy outcome.
Absolutely. You know, it's always a bit uncomfortable as two cisgender men here talk about what women should do or shouldn't do with their bodies. It's always a fraught conversation.
Yeah.
And I want to return to the child welfare piece, but before we do that, you know, is there useful information that you have found women find helpful to know about this topic that is relatively straightforward, or is it just far too complex?
I don't necessarily think it's the complexity of the message. I am concerned that social media confusing the message. And therefore, like, you know, what I advise in my trainings or in my lectures is that people should access their state information. So in Canada, you have a very good Public Health Agency of Canada. You have very, very good information around the whole issues of alcohol and pregnancy, etc. And you should be fairly confident that by accessing that information, that it is robust. It is verified by Public Health Agency of Canada. They would not have it on their site. In the same context here in Ireland, I encourage people to link to the HSE, the Health Service Executive. The Health Service Executive in Ireland has the Alcohol in Pregnancy Pocket Guide. It's an all-Ireland document that was launched in 2013 that's available on their website. And I urge women who are confused or where they would want to get this information that they go to their state bodies. So I'm saying Ireland, HSE, Canada, Public Health Agency of Canada, and they use their state information systems, because there is a lot of confused information. And the study in Canberra by Dr. Holland showed that 70 of 115 were inaccurate or confusing. That's over 50% of social media postings around alcohol and pregnancy were inaccurate, and I'm saying that 35 of them were blatantly wrong. So, and if women are left with that's their only option, then I believe that's an injustice on women. Yeah. And therefore, I encourage that women use those state systems for their information.
Yeah. You've decided to focus particularly in child welfare. Obviously, we don't always know the story of the birth mother when children come into child welfare. Saying that, do you have a sense of what the prevalence is of people with FASDs in the child welfare system?
Prevalence is a difficult, very, very difficult topic to address in the child welfare system of FASDs. And the difficulty there is that there is no, again, universal tool that measures or counts or whatever children with FASD in the system. I mean, there's different prevalence rates that have emerged out of studies at different places. I mean, Lang and colleague in Canada, I think 2013, found a 16.9% prevalence rate in a cohort in the Canadian system. Now she kind of there's various studies that have gone on. I know that the prevalence rates generally are guesstimates, and that's all they can be, is guesstimates. I know that in the study that it kind of arranged that the three provinces in Canada that would have the highest prevalence rates are Ontario, Quebec, and Alberta. Now that's again one study that says that. It's interesting because if you look at the drinking rates in pregnancy that across Canada, I think Canada is 10.7% is the national average rate. And I think that fluctuates from Prince Edward Island on one side. And in Quebec is the highest at 26.7 as an average rate. Now we compare that with Ireland, and Ireland fluctuates depending on the study. It fluctuates between 60% and 82%. And there's been studies that have come out that said that. Now, obviously people say to me when I say 82%, is that any level of alcohol? And yes, that would be any level across the thing. One of the biggest misconceptions that I've encountered in my work is around the fact that the third trimester is safe. Mm-hmm. And again, clearly what I say in my lectures or what I say in my publications is that the third trimester has the highest risk for affecting brain development. Mm-hmm. Because it's the third trimester in which the neurons are developing, the synapses, connections are happening, etc., from the fetal brain. Mm. And it's where alcohol can disrupt that process. And so you can have brain wiring that is a little bit off or a lot off. And quite often what we say in the FSD, it's from mild to severe. So you can have a mild impact or you can have a more severe impact. Mm. But like I said, I'm coming back to prevalence. There is no universal process. I mean, the concern would be that the rates are probably higher than even the prevalence rates are saying. Mm-hmm. And that ultimately, FASDs, and specifically neurodevelopment prenatal alcohol, the NDPAE is a brain-based disability and brain-based impairment of the child. And that can spurn a range of neurocognitive, neurobehavioral, neurodevelopment issues for the child. These issues are the issues that will often be the triggers of this child then entering the child welfare system. And it's that NDPAE, it's probably the most prevalent of our child welfare piece. There is no way of documenting. And that is one of the challenges of the child welfare system, I think, globally, is that even if we go with Lang's prevalence rate of 16.9, that's quite a high prevalence rate of these children in the system. And again, you know, I don't want to work out the percentage of that in terms of Canadian system, whatever, but it's still a quite a high percentage of children that are in the system. And I think the system would say that we need to respond to all children. Mm-hmm. So that's 16.9. And I think that, therefore, there is a need for the development of a mechanism within child welfare to somehow record and document both the diagnosed and the undiagnosed FSD cases that are in child welfare. Now, I have presented internationally in the past, and I've been radical, and my radical side said, we should be considering adding this to the four definitions of harm in our child welfare system. We have neglect, we have physical abuse, we have sexual abuse, we have emotional abuse. Within those systems, here in Ireland, we have SWIS, the Social Work Information System. But in most developed, now I'm not sure the Canadian system, but again, it has an information database system of when children enter the system, where they're logged and registered. And I think it's not too far a wrench for us to go to actually to start to register these kids. Now, someone said to me, oh God, no, it's not child abuse. And I said, well, neglect in our child welfare system is not necessarily child abuse. I think we respond to 80, 90% of our neglect cases in a supportive, empowering, we're not going in preventative measures or a powering method of trying to say, well, no, you're a bad parent and we take your kids away. A lot of families we work with and we empower them and we bring them back to whatever, to full kind of productivity if we can. That's part of what, so our four definitions that we currently work with are not all about child abuse. You know, sexual abuse, yes, it is a very legal and it's a punitive response that we would give to that. But we do not give punitive on neglect except for very small percentages. And I'm saying, in same way that I'm saying that in that we work with neglect cases where we put in family support services, where we put in a range of services to help that family, in the same way that these children suffering FASD and their caregivers need the same level of services. So adding FASD or suspected FSD to our child welfare databases and having somewhere that we could log these cases is a way to start actually documenting our prevalence rates that are not guesstimates, that we can say that our social work information system is giving us a 10% or is giving us a 20% or is giving us whatever. So that's a bit radical. Right. I know that maybe that's a bit radical to say, but we have to do something for these kids.
As you say, what the current status quo, the current norms are not working because people don't know what to do.
Yes.
And as we move towards closing our conversation, you know, it's a spectrum and every single person is different on that spectrum. And there's lots of, you know, what's going to be appropriate for one person, it's not going to be appropriate for another person. Are there things that caregivers can do or look to from that social perspective about, okay, I'm a foster parent, I have this young person, I think maybe they have FASD, or I know they have FASD, what do I do now?
Yeah. It's a good question. It's a good question, you know. I suppose over the years, like, you know, that I have encountered caregivers and adoptive parents in all different walks of life and in different jurisdictions. And the thing that has struck me through all of those is that their needs are very, very similar. And they want to be able to understand their child. They want to be able to give the best to the child that they're caring for. And I think FASD, because it's a very, very broad disability, that there is no one kind of technique that you can say, and this will work, this will work with this child. And I think it is a trial and error to try and find the best fit for. I suppose, like, you know, what I do say to carers is to read some of your social researchers. And yes, I have some stuff out there that I'm so chuffed that people are reading. I get kind of 6 monthly stats on the last publication, and I'm always kind of gobsmacked that people are buying and reading it.
So maybe you could tell us the name of your book?
Well, it's a co-authored book with a foster parent from the UK, but it's called Understanding Fetal Autism Spectrum Disorders, A Guide for Parents, Carers, Professionals. It's with Jessica Kingsley Publishers in London. It's freely available. But, you know, foster carers, I think, you know, someone like Christine Petrenko at Rochester University in New York. Christine, again, has done a lot of qualitative research around the needs of foster parents, and she's written quite a number of papers that are, I would hold them up as quite really good research papers. The methodology is very strong, etc. So I would say to carers that, like, you know, to look for and to follow your social researchers. Dr. Bardry, I mentioned that the minute, Dorothy Bardry, assistant professor at Alberta. Dorothy has done some fantastic work. I think, again, she has published a lot of work. Now, again, one of her papers, it was co-authored with Choate, I can't remember his first name, but Disability, A Need of Social Work Education. FSD is a Disability, Need of Social Work Education. That was published, I think, 2015. But she clearly demonstrated that FASDs in the child welfare system are a significant problem, and they need a significant response. But what they need is for child welfare to, and I think it has to happen at policy level to buy in. And before we finish, I just want to kind of to give a shout out to kind of some systems that are happening. But primarily I'm looking at the moment, I would argue that New Zealand model, 2016, they introduced, I think, a 3-year strategy. Now, you might say, 3 years, what's it going to do? But they're actually building it in 3 years, that they're going to review it and they're going to come back to it and they're going to see where they got in the 3 years. But I think if people read that 3-year strategy, I think the first thing they will see is that a high emphasis on the child welfare piece. They brought the child welfare piece to the table from the very beginning. And therefore, I think, you know, in reading the document, I was in no doubt that the child welfare system, social work system, is going to get addressed in the FSD debate. The other place I would really kind of think, I mentioned Alberta. Alberta is just out on its own. It has been for years, and it certainly shows how social work and the child welfare piece is integrated. The other place that's come to the table late but is really making rapid ground is Ontario, which I think is your home base. Ontario, again, and I think it was under the direct premiership of Kathleen Wynne, they got a round table together of people. Child welfare was at that table. There was the key agencies, there was education, there was, everyone is at that table, and they're cascading it from the top, but they're cascading it down through the different pieces that's needed. Because again, I speak to carers, and the education piece is a massive, massive piece for them as caregivers. Their children are in the classrooms, the teachers don't understand the FSD disability. Barry Carpenter, OBE in the UK, I would highly recommend his work from the education systems point of view, that Barry Carpenter has done a lot of work with the education. But it's interesting to note that Ontario are currently, I think it's just closed, but they had a tender out for an FSD services to come in, and they're calling it the FSD One-Stop Hub. And it's to include a directory of program services and supports for individuals living with FSD and their families and caregivers available in Ontario. An inventory of current FSD information, training, education opportunities, service providers and professionals and caregivers. FSD training webcasts for professionals and service providers in a variety of sectors, a discussion forum, and current research on effective intervention strategies for individuals living with FSD. So that's where Ontario is coming from. And again, I'm so impressed that it has such a social work, social lens, and the child welfare piece is firmly recognised within it. Because the prevalence rates, are there, but it's the real needs, what I'm seeing and what we see in social media. I'm constantly hearing caregivers go to social media to complain that they're not being supported. Yeah. And I think social work, we have to come back to the table. We were there in 1973 in Washington, and I think somehow we've got diluted, and I'm saying that social work needs to come back. And I think, you know, my study at the moment, I'm talking to social workers. I'm very impressed here in Ireland that some social workers really starting to push the boundaries and to address this for their families. And there's some really good pockets of work happening. And I'm really delighted to see that happening here in Ireland, because we have many, many families and we have many children in need of both social work. But I've always said social work cannot deal with this on its own. Mm-hmm. Speech language, occupational therapy, psychology. That's your ideal sort of wraparound piece of a child, with or without a diagnostic. But if you put those pieces around a child, that child has a much, much greater chance of succeeding. And I think that's what I'm hoping to do in my doctoral study at the moment. I'm documenting how social workers feel in their role. And at the moment, they're doing some great work, but they're advocating against the tide. On one level, there's a very heavy medical model that's dominating the discourse. On another level, they're trying to respond to these caregivers that are making strong demands on them. So social work is in a fairly desperate need to be given the proper supports, be it policy guidance, be it training, be it whatever supports, but social work need those supports.
And I think you are doing an excellent job of articulating what those needs are and the reason that social work and social services needs to be at the table. And I want to thank you very, very much for taking the time to speak with me today and for all your work. And I'm excited to see where it goes and how it develops.
Yeah. Well, again, I said to Wolfgang, I thank you for giving me the opportunity to, you know, I've been doing this for many years. And, you know, it can be a lonely road at times, because I think advocating for social work and advocating the child welfare piece is tough. It is a lonely road. So I'm always grateful when someone says, keep it up, keep going, you know.
Indeed.
Thank you.
This concludes this month's episode of CYC Podcast. Tune in next time for more discussions on child and youth care. Subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher. Visit us on our website at cycpodcast.org. Follow us on Facebook at facebook.com/cycpodcast.